Hello, on this week's program, a conversation with David Robertson, music director of the St. Louis Symphony Orchestra, conducts the Philadelphia Orchestra in the last of a three-concert series at the Kimmel Center this evening. As Pennsylvania lawmakers work on the state budget, Susan Lewis looks at how the Commonwealth funds arts and culture and the possible consequences of threatened cutbacks. And Jason Pfeiffer explores the rich tradition of handcrafted metalwork in Philadelphia as the Philadelphia Museum of Art opens Wrought and Crafted, Jewelry and Metalwork 1900 to the Present, and the Society of North American Goldsmiths holds its annual convention in the city. That's all I have this morning, creatively speaking.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.
California native David Robertson is among a select group of American conductors whose career first blossomed not in this country, but in overseas concert halls and opera houses. After graduating from London's Royal Academy of Music, Robertson spent the next 20 or so years working in Europe, the Middle East, and beyond, with only occasional engagements in the U.S. It wasn't until 2005 that he landed his first major appointment in this country when he was appointed music director of the St. Louis Symphony Orchestra. He was also named principal guest conductor of the BBC Symphony Orchestra that year, and it's in that role that later this year he will conduct the last night of the Proms, the most visible event in the British classical music calendar. Robertson's work with St. Louis has enhanced both that orchestra's artistic standing and his own reputation as a conductor, to the point where his name was being touted as a candidate for now-filled vacancies at the helms of the Chicago Symphony Orchestra and the New York Philharmonic. And like most visiting guest conductors to Philadelphia these days, Robertson is also being viewed here as a potential future music director. We caught up with David Robertson earlier this week backstage at the Kimmel Center. Most of the biographical information that I've come across about you always starts off with the words American conductor.
Yes.
Is there a reason for that? Because to my mind, you probably have the most foreign of career progressions of any American conductor.
Right. You know, it's very funny where people put monikers on you. You know, in Europe, I was an American conductor, but that was because I was born in America. And then coming back to the United States, I get the feeling that people refer to American conductor, you know, because it's local boy does good. It's just you're a local boy in a country of 300 million, which makes you feel a little bit, you know, part of a larger community. So I've spent a lot of time in Europe, in various different countries. More than half my life was in Europe, although having been come back to the States permanently since about 2003, I'm gradually evening up the amount that, you know, I've been in one place or the other.
How much has that defined who you are now, the early part of your career being spent in places like France?
You know, it clearly has left a large mark, mainly because the first thing that happens when you are outside of your own country is that you begin to see things about your own country that you don't notice when you're there. So if you go into a supermarket in the United States, you walk down the aisle with the breakfast cereals and you don't really notice that there is an entire aisle devoted to usually sugar-coated grain products. And if you go to France, you go into the supermarket and you find that there's almost nothing as a breakfast cereal for you to eat, whereas you can go over to the cheese department and there are more cheeses than you will ever be able to learn to pronounce. So it's a thing that first happens, and then when you learn other languages, you start learning things about your own language and the way that you speak and the way that you think in one language or another language. And all of this then leaves its mark very definitely. So when I'm doing, for example, French music with an American orchestra, I try to get them to be as close to how the music would sound within the French cultural context as possible. At the same time, you can have experiences like the one I had here in Philadelphia about, I guess, 6 years ago, something like that, where I had performed one of the quintessential American works, Copland's Appalachian Spring, in Ireland, in Germany, in England, in Israel, but I'd never performed it in the United States. And so here I came in, and just after the Gift to Be Simple, the Shaker Variations, you have a kind of choral melody written for the strings that is nothing more than a a sort of imitation of a Protestant hymn, very simple New England type of hymn. And I'd always worked on how to play it with other orchestras. I played it with the Philadelphia Orchestra at the first read-through in the rehearsal. I had to apologize to the orchestra because I started weeping. Because here was something that, and you can imagine, imagine a teacher of Greek, for example, who is struggling to get people and listening to people doing a very good job but still mispronouncing the language the entire time, and then they go to the country where everyone speaks this fluently and the pronunciation is perfect and the understanding of subtle nuances are all beyond what anyone has ever hoped for. It's enough to make you weep out of joy that there is this understanding. And that was what happened to me when the Philadelphia Orchestra played it. And so many things automatically were understood. And I think this is how music works within a cultural context. So it allows us, when we hear a work of French or German music or Russian music or Italian music or Japanese music, to go to that place even by staying in the same seat.
When you're working, I don't know, say working in London with the BBC Symphony as against working in St. Louis, is your approach different in terms of what the expectations of the audience are? Because the expectations of European audiences and of American audiences can be significantly different.
They can, but I think you actually need to speak about the particular audience in a particular place. I already have a great deal of difficulty generalizing about an audience, because when I've met specific audience members for the first time after a concert, the things that they will often say in a real interaction will be so surprising and interesting that I realize immediately that if there are 2,000 people, it's not a public, it's 2,000 individuals who happen to be in the same place to listen to the same pieces at the same time. And that changes the nature of the way you view the whole thing. So I've often heard it said, oh, well, you know, you can get great publics for modern pieces in Europe and you can't get them in the United States. This is usually said by Europeans, and the subtext is because Americans are stupid. They're trying to make the Americans are stupid argument, and there are many places where you could probably make this, but you could also make this argument about any group of people on the planet in the wrong context. Everybody's stupid. I do not know what berries are poisonous in a New Guinea forest, for example, and so I would look really stupid in that context. However, one of the main things that people tend to overlook when they're talking about that difference of, you know, it's hard to play modern music for American audiences, American halls are often larger than European halls. St. Louis has 2,700 seats. When I was in Lyon, which has quite a large hall, that's 500 seats more than the auditorium in Lyon. So already that's quite an extra percentage that you have to try and get into the hall to listen to the music. On top of that, in London, when I play a concert with the BBC Symphony Orchestra, or when the London Symphony Orchestra plays a concert, or the Royal Philharmonic plays a concert, or the London Philharmonic plays a concert, or the Philharmonia plays a concert, you see where I'm going with this. There are a number of different orchestras. They play it once. They do not repeat. If I'm playing a concert with an American orchestra, I can repeat anywhere from 2, 3, 4, or sometimes even 5 times the same program. And that means that instead of trying to expect an audience of, say, 1,500 people to listen to a modern work, you are actually expecting anywhere from 8,000 to 12,000 people to listen to the modern work. And all of a sudden, that's a completely different proportion of people to 1,500. And it becomes harder to play a more demanding work for 12,000 people than it does for 1,200 people. I think that's one of the calculations that tends to get lost. And this is where the details in all of the narration of what happens in concert life really come down to being important.
But American audiences are less backward about coming forward if they don't like something. Will that be the case? Have you ever heard booing in a European hall, for instance?
Oh, yes. I have heard booing in a European hall. I have been part of that, and I remember once coming off the stage and thinking, well, yeah, it wasn't that great a performance, and then realizing, oh, no, they just hate the piece.
I want to look ahead, if we can, to September the 12th, when you will conduct the last night of the Proms and become only the second American ever to do so.
That's right. I guess that's true. You know, it's one of those things on the last night of the Proms is a real experience, and it's definitely right at the center of so much of the British experience of music and has been for a long time. I went from Southern California to London, and in London I studied at the Royal Academy of Music, and so I discovered a really rich musical culture that to some extent I had not known existed. I discovered that Elgar wrote more pieces than Pomp and Circumstance, for example, and some of them are really hugely beautiful and complex and in-depth and the kind that you could never walk to at graduation. And that was fascinating. And then you find out all sorts of other things. And so for me, when the BBC said, we'd like you to do the last night of the Proms if you're able, it was the kind of, you know, Cinderella type of fairy tale, because that's the sort of thing that you never expect you'll ever be asked to do in your life. I think it's not quite as exclusive as being knighted,
but it's
more fun. It's certainly more fun, just because there's a whole spirit about the thing which is just absolutely joyous and really, I suppose I'm still a little bit, as the British would say, gobsmacked. I just don't really believe it's going to be me. I'm going to have to pinch myself when I'm actually up there doing things.
And it is one of those evenings where all of the rules about behavior at concerts go out the window.
Well, the idea is that you're there to have a good time. And I actually think that's what the rules at concerts should be like. And the last night of the Proms, indeed, does have this notion of you can throw off the kind of stuffiness that many people associate with classical music, unfortunately, I think, because I don't think it's there. And then, you know, you just enjoy yourself.
David Robertson, he conducts the Philadelphia Orchestra in the last of a 3-concert series featuring works by Vaughan Williams, Addis, Sibelius and Scriabin at the Kimmel Center's Verizon Hall this evening at 8.
You're listening to Creatively Speaking on WRTI.
It's now budget-making time for nearly every state in the Union. And as lawmakers struggle to contain deficits, some arts programs appear to be fighting for their lives. Last year, Pennsylvania arts groups received approximately $70 million from state government, or roughly 0.25% of a nearly $28 billion general fund budget. Proposed budget cuts threaten to reduce that funding to less than 0.1% of next year's general fund. Yet how the arts are funded is nearly as significant as by how much. Apart from grants given by state art agencies through a peer review process, tens of millions of dollars are given with the support of individual state lawmakers for local economic and community development projects. Now WRTI's Susan Lewis considers the hows and whys of state arts funding in Pennsylvania.
There are currently 2 proposed versions of the Pennsylvania state budget. The plan passed by the Senate eliminates all funding for the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts. Senate Majority Leader Dominic Pileggi says it's not about the art, it's about the math.
The goal was rather simple. We determined we had $27.3 billion in revenues, and we needed to craft a spending plan that did not exceed the money that we had available to spend.
The House has not yet acted on a proposal from Governor Ed Rendell, which reduces arts funding along with other across-the-board cuts.
If we do the budget the right way, we'll be able to maintain a substantial amount of funding for things that are important, like the arts. If we do it the wrong way and then follow the Senate budget, we have no funding for the arts, no funding for so many things that are important.
The budget process has the agencies committed to arts and culture scrambling in a cultural landscape where arts groups are already struggling.
Subscriptions are diminishing. Corporate giving is down. Foundation giving is down.
Diane Dalto is chair of the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts, which gives over 1,400 grants to arts groups throughout the Commonwealth. She says the loss of this state funding would have an especially big impact on small and medium-sized organizations, as well as programs in rural areas.
There are small arts programs in counties that don't have choices. They only have one little repertory theater or one dance company or one dance education after school program. They don't have foundations. They don't have corporations to go to, and they don't have wealthy patrons. Some of the rural, smaller organizations are dependent on us for most of their programming.
Grant making is a strategy to serve the people of Pennsylvania.
Arts Council Executive Director Philip Horn says the council regards grantees as partners.
By helping them do their job, do it better, reach more people, we move towards achieving our mission. So we don't consider our work philanthropy. We consider it support for a valuable service.
The idea of a partnership between communities and government is also critical to federal support through the National Endowment for the Arts, says its Director of State and Regional Partnerships, John Ostrout.
When the National Endowment for the Arts was formed in 1965, one of the initial parts of the legislation was that every state, in order to receive money from the federal government, had to have a permanent arts commission, and that arts commission had to match funding that came from the federal government.
Because of this enabling legislation,
if the state did not have a permanent arts commission and matched the funds that came from the federal government through the National Endowment for the Arts, we wouldn't be able to provide them with the funding.
And so, although the state Senate's bill appears to count on NEA funds to the State Arts Council, eliminating the state's portion would also eliminate those federal funds. In response to this apparent contradiction, Senate Majority Leader Dominic Pileggi acknowledges that some cuts will result in the loss of matching funds and says he's open to ideas about reallocating spending.
There is the possibility, frankly, and one that I invited, that if individuals or organizations thought that there was a better way to allocate the available revenues, I was certainly open to a discussion of that. But the arts line that you're referring to is a relatively small part of the overall $27.3 billion spending plan.
And there's the rub. If the arts are a small part of the budget, around 0.25%, why decimate them? Pileggi denies that arts cuts are disproportionate, but with the elimination of funding for the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts, there's nothing left in that agency to reallocate. Aside from the support from the State Arts Council, museums around the state get funding from the Pennsylvania Historical and Museum Commission, whose budget was cut first by the governor's proposal, then cut deeper by the Senate. Executive Director Barbara Franco says the loss of funding under the Senate's budget would jeopardize the preservation of and public access to state-owned sites like the Landis Valley Museum, Washington Crossing Historic Park, and Pensbury Manor.
Our mission is basically twofold. It's preservation and education. With 23 historic sites all around the state, what happens if the roof leaks? We have no way to fix it. We won't have enough staff to operate them, so we may be looking at closing basically all the sites and only having a skeleton staff to provide basic security.
The governor's budget wipes out the commission's competitive grant program that helps over 150 museums and historical societies. The Senate version additionally eliminates line item appropriations to 9 museums across the state. Aside from the impact on the arts themselves, it makes little economic sense to wound an industry that provides jobs and fuels the local economy, while it enhances the quality of life, says Arts Council Chair Diane Dalto.
Arts and culture are among the most important factors in choosing where to do business and where to visit.
The value of the arts as engines of economic development is recognized somewhat by the politicians. There is, in fact, a backdoor of sorts for arts funding through the Pennsylvania Department of Community and Economic Development, or DCED.
Economic development is the focus and also community development.
DCED's Mark Shade says art programs play an important role in revitalizing communities.
To have a vibrant community, you need a vibrant arts background.
For the fiscal year 2007 to 2008, interspersed among grants to fire departments and municipal projects were grants totaling approximately $30 million to arts projects, from $5,000 grants to community groups like the Pocono Youth Orchestra and the King of Prussia Players, to a $2.5 million grant to the Pittsburgh Symphony under something described as cultural exhibitions and expositions.
That is a program that has legislative priority.
Shade explains that groups get funding one of two ways. They can apply online to one of the 80 programs listed, but there are also programs of legislative interest or priority.
It's a program, a functional program with guidelines and rules that DCED operates, but has a tendency, it's not exclusive, but lawmakers do have use of those funds to help arts organizations and other organizations, community development organizations throughout the state.
This kind of funding, secured with the help of individual lawmakers and not necessarily committed to the arts, seems a rather precarious fallback for arts advocates. And there will be less money in this pot as well. Shade says that DCED's budget, reduced in the governor's proposal from over $600 million to $400 million, was further cut in the Senate bill to below $200 million, with many of the programs completely eliminated.
Sustainable communities involve the kind of investments that the governor has been directing for the past six, 7 years. And Senate Bill 850 guts our ability to continue this mission.
What's happening in Pennsylvania is not unusual. In any budget, federal or state, for municipalities or public schools, when funds are limited, the arts are often the first thing to go. Governor Ed Rendell says that's because the arts are seen as an easy political target.
There are no direct constituencies for it, and a lot of people don't appreciate how much of an economic development generator it is. Not just in big cities like Philadelphia, but you talk to some of the smaller towns, and their arts and cultural organizations are near and dear to them. They're the heart and soul of those small towns and small cities.
Heart and soul, beauty and community, not to mention jobs and economic development. The House Appropriations Committee will continue taking written public comments through Tuesday and will resume work on the budget the first week in June. The House may approve the Senate bill, the governor's plan, or a new version of its own. Unresolved differences will likely be referred to a conference committee with representatives of each body and the governor's office.
WRTI's Susan Lewis. And by way of full disclosure, we should mention that WRTI receives funding from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts, some of which goes towards the production of this program. This weekend, over 700 members of the Society of North American Goldsmiths are meeting in Philadelphia for their 40th annual conference. The gathering is about much more than shaping and crafting gold, however. As WRTI's Jason Pfeiffer reports, the Society of Goldsmiths is also being honored by the Philadelphia Museum of Art with a new exhibition that explores the region's rich tradition of metalwork and jewelry making.
How does an ancient craft speak to us today? It's a question explored in the Art Museum's exhibition, Wrought and Crafted, Jewelry and Metalwork, 1900 to the Present. It features over 50 works created in the past century, but not by just anyone. The pieces come from artists who were either born, educated, or made their home in Philadelphia. Elizabeth Agro, Associate Curator of American Modern and Contemporary Crafts and Decorative Arts, says these artists are part of a long tradition in the city.
Philadelphia's always been a metal town since Penn coming to this country and establishing Philadelphia as a city center.
Agro says the city's original settlers included a silversmith, blacksmith, coopersmith, and pewterer, demonstrating the historic importance of metalsmiths and establishing the city early on as a center for the metal crafts in America. Today, there is no longer an everyday need for the handiwork of metalsmiths, but creativity in metalwork, from bronze sculptures to ornate ironwork to intricate jewelry, continues to be in demand. Agro says the Wrought and Crafted exhibit is a chance to show off Philadelphia's best to the visiting craftspeople.
I thought it was a great opportunity to sort of go through the basement and see what I had in storage that hadn't been on view, to sort of really explore the metals collection, what we have, what we don't have, what we want, and how we could build on that collection.
The resulting exhibition highlights a wide range of work. There's a decorative wrought iron lock, key, and handle from Samuel Yellen, a renowned master blacksmith in the early 20th century, a large weather vane sculpture, candlesticks, picnic flatware, a lamp, and a recently commissioned necklace made of polymer clay, silver, and gold, crafted in honor of the Art Museum's late director, Anne Darnancourt. One of the most striking works in Wrought and Crafted is American Ruff, created by Jan Yeager. At first glance, the piece looks like a large lace collar, the sort of elaborate fabric neck piece worn by men in 17th century Dutch paintings.
This rough, if you were to look more carefully, is actually made out of crack vials, and it's all held together by silver wire, and it's an incredibly beautiful thing, although one would never think of crack vials and beautiful being in the same sense.
Such innovative use of metals and other materials is rather commonplace for the over 3,000 members of the Society of North American Goldsmiths, an organization designed to support and advance the art of jewelers and metalsmiths. Bruce Metcalf, a historian and artist who has a necklace in the Art Museum show, says there's often a misunderstanding about what a creative jeweler or metalsmith does.
I think a lot of people hear the word jeweler and they think Sansom Street. No, they think an engagement ring with a rock on it, you know, but that isn't what we do. We don't deal with convention. We're not here to make yet another engagement ring that looks like every other engagement ring ever made. We're trying to do something with jewelry or with metalsmithing that's unusual. It's kind of pushing the envelope.
Metcalf, whose studio is in the Fishtown neighborhood of the city, says there's a lot going on in the jewelry and metalworking field in Philadelphia. It's one reason that Doug Bucci wanted to bring the Goldsmiths Conference here.
Philadelphia is really the heart and soul, I believe, of jewelry and metals.
Bucci, the co-chair of the conference and a metalwork instructor at the University of the Arts and Temple University's Tyler School of Art, says Philadelphia's preeminence in the field is due to a concentration of creative talent.
There's this powerhouse of people that really come together and live and work together here in the city.
But it's not just happenstance that so many jewelers and metalsmiths work in the area. Bruce Metcalf credits schools in the region, like the University of the Arts, the Moore College of Art and Design, Temple's Tyler School of Art, and Millersville, Kutztown, and Rowan Universities.
Jewelry and metals has been taught in Philadelphia since 1904, more than a century now. There's a kind of a focus or a concentration of these programs that are spitting out students every year, and a lot of them settle down in the area, and I'm one. I was a graduate of Tyler in 1977.
While Philadelphia is steeped in traditions of metalsmithing, it's also a place where the craft is evolving. Historically, jewelry and metalwork have been done by hand, using heat to bend and manipulate materials. But according to Bruce Metcalf, many artists in Philadelphia are interested in applying new technology to the art form, like three-dimensional printing. An artist might design a piece of jewelry, for example, on a computer, and then a machine, an actual 3D printer, produces the object.
There are a number of different processes, and they'll take gypsum or ABS plastics or nylon and actually build up three-dimensional forms layer by layer of thousandths of an inch thin. And they can build up incredibly complex three-dimensional forms with these technologies.
While many jewelers and metalsmiths have been reluctant to embrace computer-aided design, or CAD, Doug Bucci says it's becoming more widely accepted as an artistic medium. Bucci believes as science and technology continue to advance, metalsmiths must continue to be open to change if the art and craft is to remain vibrant.
So, you know, it's what's next. How do these things begin to grow? And what do you do instead of being happy with CAD for the next 20 years? What's the natural progression?
Philadelphia's culture of metalsmithing looks both backward to its traditions and forward to its future. The theme of this year's Society of North American Goldsmiths Conference is revolution, a nod perhaps to the history of its host city, to the spirit that ignited a country and permeates this ever-evolving craft.
WRTI's Jason Pfeiffer, along with over a dozen jewelry and metalwork exhibitions currently on display throughout the city, Wrought and Crafted, Jewelry and Metalwork, 1900 to the Present, is at the Philadelphia Museum of Art through January. And that's it for now. You can find an archive of past shows and subscribe to our podcast at WRTI.org. Creatively Speaking's theme music is by Bill Jolly, orchestrated by Tim Ripchester, and performed by Symphony and Sea under Rossin Milanoff. Our executive producer is Jack Moore, and I'm Jim Cotter.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.